So we had just barely gotten to slide 15 to look at this table to start the proteins section of the chapter. And as I said, this table really illustrates that proteins, compared to the other three categories of macromolecules, proteins really have a huge diversity of functions, because they are involved in just everything that goes on in cells. And you can see that these major functions are really drastically different from each other too. And the reason that proteins can have so many different functions is because whatever a function is for a given protein, it has that function because of its shape, which for a protein we call that its conformation. Shape is everything. And since if you were designing things, you can make a protein have just about any shape you want, that's why they can have so many functions. Now, you're stuck with however many proteins you're able to make. They have a specific shape each, and so they function a certain way. That's why you have your traits. But because they can be drastically different shapes from protein to protein, that's how they can have so many drastically different functions. We can see a lot of proteins being used as enzymes, for instance. There are thousands of your roughly 20,000 genes coding for proteins, meaning you have roughly 20,000 types of proteins that you make. A pretty big fraction of those are different enzymes. Enzymes we'll be studying more in detail later, but they are catalysts. Catalysts are things that speed up chemical reactions. So they allow metabolism to happen soon enough to keep you alive. Structural proteins are just what they say. They're proteins that serve as structural components in cells. You know, things that act like ropes or anchors, things like that. There are storage proteins. Now, this is a kind of a, compared to the other functions, a minor function, but for instance, albumin in the white of an egg is mostly protein, and that's storing that as nutrients for the growing embryo in the egg. Transport proteins, there's all kinds of. Transport means to move things around, like hemoglobin, as you see as an example. Major plasma protein, component of your blood that carries oxygen and carbon dioxide, and there's all kinds of other transport proteins in the blood as well, carrying things around. Many of the hormones in your body are proteins. Not all of them, but most of them are protein-based. And they function, of course, as signals. Totally different function, once again. We've talked about those a little bit. And whether a hormone, which is a signal, is a protein or not, all hormones operate, as I've said, by binding to proteins, by binding to receptors. Well, receptors in all cases are proteins, which makes sense because a receptor has to have just the right shape to fit that signal, and proteins can have just about any shape. And then there are contractile and motor proteins. This is how your muscles operate in your heart, which is muscle. They get shorter because of interactions of proteins. And then there are defensive proteins like the antibodies that are important for your immunity. That's once again based on shape, because antibodies recognize foreign material based on its shape. It can do that only if the antibody itself has the right kind of shape. All right, well, that's just a brief overview of the functions. Let's talk more about the molecules themselves. 16, speaking of enzymes, shows you an enzyme in blue or purple, whatever color that is in the book or on your computer. Like I said, this is a big fraction of your overall proteins. They operate as enzymes. And an enzyme is a catalyst. It speeds up a reaction, but a catalyst is not a reactant. It participates in the reaction, but it's not a reactant, because in any given chemical reaction, the reactants, whatever are on the left side of the arrow, get turned into products, right? If the chemical reaction occurs, the reactants change. They get converted into product. But that's not true for a catalyst. A catalyst helps out that process, but the catalyst itself does not get changed. So in other words, they're reusable. As long as there's more reactant, the catalyst can do that again, help out another bit of reactant to become product. And if it's a catalyzed reaction, then the reactants are called substrates. Substrates get turned into product by binding first to enzymes. And for instance, in this example reaction, sucrose, a disaccharide that we've talked about, table sugar, gets broken apart. What kind of reaction would do that?
Catalyst.
Well, the catalyst is a participant in the reaction, but it's not the reaction. It is catabolic because catabolism is the half of metabolism that breaks big things into small. Anabolism is the other half of metabolism that builds big things out of smaller things. But I'm talking about the reactions we discussed in the first part of this chapter. What kind of reactions break bigger things into smaller?
Oh, the dehydration.
No, a dehydration builds things, big things out of smaller. Yes, this is hydrolysis. But hydrolysis is greatly aided by a catalyst. A catalyst isn't necessary for a chemical reaction, so it can happen without the help of the catalyst, but probably no time soon. And so a typical catalyst will speed up a reaction at least a million times faster. Well, you see that, though, for that to happen, the substrate, which is the reactant, has to bind temporarily to a special place on the enzyme with just the right shape, and we call that the active site. And by doing that, and how it happens depends on the specific enzyme and the substrate, but when that happens, when that substrate binds to the enzyme, it causes things to be better off in terms of the likelihood of the reaction happening. In this case, maybe it stresses the bond, as you see here, by bending it, and therefore makes it more easy to break. And when it breaks, when that hydrolysis occurs, then you no longer have the disaccharide, you have the products, the individual monosaccharides that the sucrose was made out originally, which are glucose and fructose. And those then leave the enzyme, which leaves the enzyme back in its original configuration. That's why it's a cycle, to illustrate the reusability of enzymes. All right, now to 17. Enzymes is just one of many types of proteins. As we saw on the table, there's all kinds of other proteins doing totally different jobs. But in all cases, proteins are polymers made out of monomers, which is kind of redundant. A polymer, by definition, is made out of monomers. But proteins are like the other two polymers of the four categories of macromolecules. Which one was not a polymer? Yeah, lipids are not polymers, although they're macromolecules. The other three are. So polysaccharides, as we've already looked at, are polymers made out of monomers called what?
Monosaccharides.
You hook a bunch of monosaccharides together, you get a polysaccharide. Well, a protein is also a polymer, but it uses totally different monomers. The monomers are amino acids. Each monomer is an amino acid. And we're looking at a single amino acid here, or at least the general scheme of an amino acid. This actually isn't an amino acid because there's no such atom as R, right? Just like R represented the rest of the molecule for functional groups. That's what it represents here. So in order for any given molecule to be an amino acid, it has to have all of this in place. There has to be a central carbon, the so-called alpha carbon, the one in magenta. And you're used to carbon making four bonds. In this case, it forms four single bonds, one of which is with a carboxyl group. You should recognize that even though it's labeled, you should recognize just the yellow part as being carboxyl, right? And what do we call substances that contain a carboxyl group? Right, carboxylic acids. Okay, so this thing is a carboxylic acid. But the second requirement after, the second thing bonded to the C in the center is a hydrogen. Third, and I shouldn't say first, second, and third, because there's no order to it, I'm just working clockwise, is the salmon-colored one here, which even though it's labeled, you should recognize as an amino group, right? Nitrogen and two hydrogens. And anything else can take up the fourth position. That's what R represents. Anything. So the simplest possibility would be just another hydrogen there. That's one possible amino acid. But it could be anything else. And not just a single atom necessarily. This can be a group of atoms. All right. But as long as all the rest of it is exactly as in this figure, then that thing is an amino acid. So that should tell you, therefore, since R can be anything, that there's an infinite number of possible amino acids, right? And that's true. You can make amino acids in the laboratory any way you want them, as long as all of this is the same. And you just make R whatever you want. But one of the several pieces of compelling evidence pointing to the fact that we all organisms that have ever lived descended from the original successful cells, that trunk of the tree of life that I keep talking about, is that all organisms use the same set of 20 amino acids to build their proteins. So you might read that there are 20 amino acids. Well, no, there's infinite amino acids, but there are 20 biological amino acids, 20 that organisms use. And we'll look at those probably in the next slide. I can't remember what the next slide is. Yeah, slide 18. These are the 20 biological amino acids that make up all the proteins that all organisms use. And first of all, notice that it's not really shading, it's the white part. That's the R group in all of these. Notice that if you ignore the R group, every one of these is exactly the same. It has all that structure that I just talked about. A carboxyl on one side, an amino, a hydrogen, and then something else. And by the way, that's why these things are called amino acids. Amino from the amino group, and acid because they're carboxylic acids since they have a carboxyl group. So they are amino acids. Well, there's 20 that organisms use, and they're all listed here, but notice they're grouped. Depending on their R groups, they have different chemical properties. All of these ones are nonpolar because the R group itself is nonpolar. Usually that happens when the R group consists of a bunch of C's and H's because those have equal electronegativities, right? Hydrocarbons are nonpolar in general. The simplest one is glycine. That's what I said is just with a hydrogen, but all the rest of them have mostly carbon and hydrogen, but in any case, they're nonpolar. On the other hand, you can have polar R groups, and that usually involves an O and an H, or an N and an H, that have pretty drastically different electronegativities. And that, of course, makes them interact with things differently compared to the nonpolar ones. Well, polar is kind of partially charged, or not kind of, it is partially charged, at least that one end is. And then on the bottom, we see that some amino acids actually have ionized R groups. So they are beyond polar. They're electrically charged because they have gained or lost electrons, or an atom in the R group has. And so those are actually are could be further subdivided into two groups based on whether it's a negative charge or a positive charge. They act as, they have acidic properties or alkaline or basic properties, depending on the charge of the R group. But the fact that these R groups can differ from amino acid to amino acid and have different chemical affinities based on polarity and non-polarity is exactly why a given protein has its shape. And we'll see that once we actually start assembling these things. These are just individual amino acids. It's the polymer made up of amino acids that has the three-dimensional shape that's important for the function. So slide 19 shows you how amino acids are linked. If you think back to linking monosaccharides to build a bigger sugar, either a disaccharide, trisaccharide, or polysaccharide, doing that uses dehydration reactions, what? Right? And same here. But remember that the ringed monosaccharide, which is what you have to have the form of in order to hook them together, has to be in the ringed form. There are multiple choices of connection points, right? Which is why polysaccharides can be branched. A single monosaccharide can simultaneously be hooked to more than one other monosaccharide. So it can branch like glycogen. But that's not true for polypeptides. Now, let me pause here and tell you about the words polypeptide and protein. Often they are used interchangeably, and sometimes it's correct that they are exactly interchangeable, but only sometimes. So I want to tell you the distinction. A polypeptide is one single chain of amino acids. However many amino acids long it is depends, but it's one long chain of amino acids. That's a polypeptide. And sometimes that's the only thing that makes up a protein. And in that case, polypeptide and protein mean the same thing. But sometimes certain proteins are actually made up of more than one polypeptide. And so in that case, the word polypeptide and protein mean slightly different things. I'll get back to this in a different slide when we talk about levels of protein structure, but polypeptide always refers to a single, however long, strand of amino acids linked together. And that's what's being built here. Now, they're called polypeptides because the bond that is formed between two amino acids when you link them together is called a peptide bond. It's the same kind of reaction, dehydration, that links together two monosaccharides. But remember, we used a different name for the bond between monosaccharides. What was that? Exactly. A glycosidic linkage connects two monosaccharides together. Here we're using the same kind of reaction, dehydration. So an H is going to be lost from one and an OH from the other to make water coming out. And that allows you to bond them together. But in this case, the bond gets the name peptide bond between two amino acids. And this peptide bond has to form, the only way it's possible, is for the amino group of one amino acid to be linked to the carboxyl group of the next amino acid. So unlike in monosaccharides, there aren't multiple possibilities for linking. It has to be this way, and that's why no polypeptide branches. A polypeptide, you know, it's kind of like the baby toys that hook together One's male and one's female, and you can only make them, there's no branching, right? You just connect them into each other. So it's always good. A polypeptide can be any length, however many amino acids, but it's always going to have two ends and no branches. All right? So we can see by the water coming out of here that this is a dehydration reaction, but the peptide bond is the name of the bond, and you can just do this over and over for as many amino acids as you want to add. Now the cell, as we'll see eventually, is told how many amino acids and which amino acids in each position to add when it builds a protein. That's what it needs instructions for. Those instructions come in the form of RNA, which is created by reading the instructions in DNA originally. So remember when we talked about the two functions of DNA? What were those? No, because it's proteins that give you your traits directly.
Messenger.
The two functions of DNA are transcription and replication. Transcription is what I was talking about right here. Transcription uses the information in DNA to form an RNA molecule, and that RNA molecule then informs the cell which amino acids to use in each position and how many to use until it's done. In other words, how to make a polypeptide. And that's why you don't have polypeptides unless you have instructions for how to build them, unless you have the gene corresponding to it. Okay, now, importantly here, notice that the only thing holding the chain together, the polypeptide, along its length, are these peptide bonds between amino and carboxyl groups of the adjacent amino acids. In other words, each of the R groups is just hanging off the chain. It's not holding the chain together. Right, these are R groups, and they can be anything, you know, because you can use any of the 20 amino acids in each position. So each one has a different R group. It could be several of the same over and over. But in any case, the R groups are not immediately adjacent R groups, ones right next to each other, are not forming bonds. They're not holding the chain together. It's only the peptide bonds between the carboxyls and the aminos. But even though these R groups are not holding the thing together, they are going to determine the ultimate shape of the whole thing once it's built. They're going to keep it from just being a long strand that is stretched out. It's going to take on a three-dimensional shape. So in 20, we can see a couple representations of a protein, or I should say a polypeptide, because this is a single polypeptide. The first, this is the same protein in both cases. Lysozyme doesn't matter. That's just an example of an enzyme. But the point here is that you can depict these things as polypeptides, that is, with a ribbon model, like in the left, or a space-filling model, which is nice that we're able to make those, but it doesn't really give you as much information, in my opinion, as the ribbon model. The ribbon model is, the good thing about that is that it shows you that you're talking about a single polypeptide that does not branch, just like a ribbon doesn't branch. It has two ends, and that's, you know, it's not stretched out. It folds back and forth and has a specific shape. Now these yellow things, those are bonds between certain R groups that get close to each other, but only because of the folding of the overall polypeptide. And that stabilizes it. We'll talk about those in a minute. But this thing operates, in this case, as an enzyme, specifically because of the way it folds up into three dimensions and has a shape, including this groove that is the active site for that specific enzyme. Only the right kind of thing, the substrate, can fit in there and will be turned into product for a specific chemical reaction. So there are thousands of different chemical reactions happening in your cells. I'm not talking about thousands of copies of reactions, thousands of different kinds of reactions happening simultaneously. And almost effectively, every one of them requires its own custom enzyme, which is why so many of your genes are devoted to coding for thousands of different enzymes that can catalyze those individual reactions independently. 21 is a different representation of proteins. Here you have proteins from two different organisms. Well, I shouldn't say organisms because the virus isn't an organism. But you have a flu virus, which is has a protein part, and an antibody. This is showing you how important shape is. Antibodies work by recognizing, just like a lock and key mechanism, a specific type of foreign material. And so that alerts your body, this could hurt you, it's not part of you, so we better get rid of it. That's how immunity works. All right, now to 22, and I was hinting about this earlier. This is a slide that illustrates four levels of protein shape or protein conformation. And they are sensibly named: primary, first; secondary, tertiary, quaternary. That just means first, second, third, and fourth. Every protein has at least the first three levels. All right? And only some proteins, in addition to those first three levels, have the fourth. And that's where the distinction between the words protein and polypeptide come in. Okay, so let's start with primary structure, which refers to simply the specific order of amino acids in one polypeptide. So glycine, proline, threonine, you don't have to know these abbreviations, but those are individual amino acids of the 20. So any given single polypeptide has a certain length, a certain number of amino acids, and each position is a specific type of amino acid. That is the primary structure. And that's what a gene specifies. It specifies as the primary structure of a polypeptide. But whatever that primary structure is determines all the higher levels of structure. All right. Our secondary structure refers to whether or not there are certain repeating motifs, including alpha helices, the plural of helix, a corkscrew shape, and beta pleated sheets, kind of an accordion shape. You see these often repeated because they give certain qualities to the overall protein. But that's secondary structure. Whether it has these things, how many there are, and where they are. So that's secondary structure is not the full shape of the polypeptide. It's just part of the shape. All right? The tertiary structure, on the other hand, is the overall three-dimensional shape that one polypeptide has when it folds up. So it starts kind of like a string of beads. That's what a single polypeptide is like. And you know, if you imagine building it, well, you have a set of beads to work with. You can make it any length you want, use as many beads as you want. Each position, though, you have 20 choices of different beads to use. Now, you can imagine how many different necklaces you could make out of that. Infinite number, really, right? Because you could make it as long as you want. But even if you cap it at, let's say you have to stop at 1,000 beads, there's still a hell of a big number when it's 20 to the 1,000th power, which is a huge number, because you have 20 choices for each individual one. So 20 times 20 for 2, 20 times 20 times 20 for 3, and so on. That's why there's effectively no limit to the number of possible shapes that a protein can have. But that would be the primary structure, just that necklace by itself. Well, it's not going to stay as a necklace. It's going to fold up and curl up certain ways based on what the R groups are. They fold up a certain way because some R groups like to be around other R groups. Some are trying to avoid other R groups based on whether they're polar or nonpolar. And so the R groups, the chemical natures of the R groups determines ultimately the tertiary structure, the overall three-dimensional shape that that polypeptide will have. Now, some proteins consist of just one polypeptide, as I said earlier. And therefore, those kinds of proteins have only primary, secondary, and tertiary structure. Because the tertiary structure is the shape of the one polypeptide, and if that's all it is, then that's the entire protein. And only in those cases do the words protein and polypeptide mean exactly the same thing. But often you have more complex proteins that are called multimeric proteins. Now, this is really the same word, meaning-wise, as polymer. Multimer and polymer mean the same thing. They're just using different prefixes for many, because polymer is already being used for the single polypeptide is already a polymer. A multimeric protein is one that's made out of multiple polypeptides. There's more than one polymer in it. All right? So multiple necklaces, at least two. And it doesn't matter whether those two or more polypeptides are identical to each other or different. If they come together to make up an even more complex protein, then we call the protein multimeric. And by the way, when I say come together, I don't mean that you take one polypeptide, which is a string of beads, and another one, and you link them end to end. That would just be making one longer polypeptide, right? So in a multimeric protein, each polypeptide, however many there are, at least two, remain individual polypeptides. Each of them still has two ends. Each of them is one ribbon. But they are associated with each other and held together somehow to make that more complex protein. That's a quaternary structure. The quaternary structure is the overall three-dimensional shape based on the association of multiple polypeptides that are constituents of the overall protein. And you can see that right here. This one looks like three at least, maybe four, I don't know. But like I said, it has to be at least two. Each of these globs is one overall polypeptide. This one has multiple ones, though. All right. So in that case, when you're talking about something that has quaternary structure, then protein and polypeptide are not interchangeable. Protein refers to the overall protein, however many polypeptides make it up. And polypeptide, as always, just refers to one ribbon, which in this case would be just part of the protein. Explains those little yellow lines that I showed you in the lysozyme that I said was bonding the thing together, stabilizing its shape. That's right here in yellow again. But there's more than just one type of bond that can be made between non-adjacent R groups. Adjacent means they're right next to each other, right? So those two amino acids are covalently bonded by a peptide bond to hold them together, and the R groups are hanging off. Those typically don't interact much with each other, the R groups of adjacent amino acids. But if they're far apart and you bend the necklace, then they can come together. So it's non-adjacent R groups that are interacting here, right? This one is, if you stretch this out, is not very close to this one. But by bending the necklace, you get these two R groups together. And that's why the thing takes on its shape, because of these interactions between non-adjacent R groups. And you can see here four major ways in which R groups can interact with each other. One of which is hydrogen bonding in blue. We're already familiar with this, right? Some R groups have polar, I mean, some amino acids have polar R groups. So you have an OH hanging off of this one, you have an O hanging off of this one. And just like O and H attract each other in different water molecules, you can have hydrogen bonding between different R groups within the same polypeptide. Now that's not a chemical bond, remember. So it's not hard to break that, but it's more than nothing, and therefore it contributes to the shape, so it's important. You can also have what are called hydrophobic interactions, and that's between nonpolar R groups. Notice these are all hydrocarbons. And from what I've told you, you would expect hydrocarbons not to be attracted to each other, right? Because they're nonpolar. Which is true unless the electrons, which remember are moving, since they're shared electrons, they're moving back and forth between carbons and hydrogens. So at any given moment, they are either at the carbon or the hydrogen. It's equal sharing, so they're spending the same amount of time, but at any given, if you stop the clock, any given instant, they are either at the carbon or at the hydrogen. So here's a carbon from one and a hydrogen from the other. These are two different amino acids. This carbon is sharing electrons with another. Let me draw it just the way it is here. You have CH3, right? On each of them. But it's this H and this H that are going to actually be attracted to each other. Because this pair of electrons is being shared by both of these. Well, if it happens just perfectly that the electrons are at the moment, we're stopping the clock, closer to the C, and this one happens to be closer to the H, and then the very next moment it'll switch, the electron will be there and there, and it keeps going in synchrony that way, then they actually will be temporarily have a tiny charge, right? Because when the electron's down here, that'll make this positive. When the electron is here, it'll make this negative. And then it'll switch polarity because these electrons are doing this. And it has to be just right, but that does happen. So that's how nonpolar things can still attract each other. That's a tiny, tiny force, but important because you can have a lot of those. As a matter of fact, this is... I think that's how geckos are able to just walk on glass on a ceiling without falling off. A bunch of hydrophobic interactions between their feet and the glass. The strongest by far are these yellow ones, which are called disulfide bridges. That's what you were seeing as yellow slashes in the lysozyme slide. And this happens when an R group containing a sulfhydryl. Do you remember what a sulfhydryl is? Yes, it's just like a hydroxyl, only with sulfur and hydrogen instead of oxygen hydrogen. So one R group will have an SH. That's somewhere on the necklace. And then after bending, another one with another sulfhydryl group. Whoops. Will be put right into proximity with that. And when that happens, each sulfhydryl loses its hydrogen, leaving a hole in the S so that they can be bonded together. So that's why it's by far the strongest. This is an actual covalent bond that's occurred now. And when that happens, and especially when there's a bunch of them within the polypeptide, that really locks the three-dimensional shape into place more than if you didn't have those disulfide bridges. And so you see this on a lot of structural proteins that have to really be strong, like hair, for instance, which is why if you burn hair, you get that sulfur smell. It has a lot of disulfide bridges in it. And then this other blue one, I don't know why they couldn't think of a fourth color, but this blue one on the bottom is interactions between oppositely charged charged groups. Remember, beyond polar on that bottom box of the amino acids, you had the charged ones. Well, if a negatively charged one gets close to a positively charged one, then you can have an ionic bond, just like in a salt. So these two are actually chemical bonds. These two are much weaker, but they're still important. And the overall three-dimensional shape, or the tertiary structure of the overall polypeptide, is a function of which amino acids you have in which sequence. Everything is a consequence of the primary structure, which is the overall sequence, because that overall sequence is going to determine the specific shape it's going to wrap up into using these interactions. If you had a, in other words, you could use exactly the same number and types of beads, but if you don't have them in the right order, just like a necklace would look different if you did that, it's going to fold up differently because it's not going to bring the same kinds of R groups together the same way. Now, in 24, we have two example proteins, and these actually both happen to be multimeric proteins. That's not the point, but recognize that each of these is multimeric because each of them is made up of at least two polypeptides that are hooked together somehow. But that's not the point, as I said. The main point here is that proteins in as a whole category can be broken into two categories, based subcategories, based on shape, based roughly on shape, regardless of their function, really, just based on their shape. And one category, represented by collagen here, an important animal protein that we have a bunch of in our body, is fibrous protein. Fibrous proteins are like fibers. They're longer in one dimension than another. And they usually function as fibers, as ropes, basically, things that can be pulled on. The other major category is globular proteins. A globular protein is more compact. It's not especially long in one dimension. Not necessarily a perfect sphere. Obviously not going to be a perfect sphere, but it's, you know, like the enzymes that we looked at already, those, or the antibody, those were globular. Hemoglobin's a good example of that. Speaking of hemoglobin, in slide 25, we can use it as an example to once again illustrate this. I've already said this many times, but this once again illustrates the link between, I mean, the fact that proteins are the link between genes and traits. All right, you have genes to start with. That's in the DNA. And, no DNA is shown here. We're going to revisit this later when we look at DNA. But anyway, DNA specifies RNA. That's transcription. RNA then specifies the sequence of amino acids when this thing gets built. And that's what valine, histidine, leucine is. That's the primary structure, right? The specific sequence of amino acids in a polypeptide. Well, hemoglobin is made up of four overall polypeptides. It's a multimeric protein, but it's two identical polypeptides and then two other identical polypeptides. So there's four overall, two kinds of polypeptides. And this is showing just one of them, the light blue one, the beta subunit. There's two beta subunits, two alphas. Anyway, in order for hemoglobin to do its job, which is to carry oxygen and carbon dioxide in the blood, picks up carbon dioxide from the cells and delivers oxygen to those cells, and then it travels to the lungs via the blood and picks up new oxygen and gets rid of its carbon dioxide for you to exhale it. In order for it to do that job properly, just like any function of any protein, it has to have the right shape. And this slide illustrates that if you don't have that correct primary structure, that correct sequence of amino acids, then you're not going to have the same shape, and it can make a big difference just with a tiny change. So here on the left we have normal hemoglobin, and this is only the first seven amino acids of however many there are in this polypeptide. But that's the correct sequence, or the normal sequence. We would call that the wild type sequence. In a person that has a mutation compared to the wild type, though, because of a change in DNA, the DNA tells it to make this version instead, which is identical except for position 6. Instead of glutamic acid, which is what the amino acid was supposed to be, it tells the cell to put a valine amino acid there instead. And the entire rest of the polypeptide is normal. But just that one different bead means it's going to fold up differently because of the interactions between the R groups we were talking about. And that results in a misshapen beta subunit, and therefore the overall hemoglobin is misshapen because it includes two misshapen betas. This is what causes sickle cell disease in humans, which is called that because instead of having this normal biconcave disc shape of a healthy erythrocyte or red blood cell, they have this sickle shape to them. And that causes all kinds of problems and premature death, which is why it's considered, which is why that's an example of a mutation that ends up not doing as good a job as the original one, right? But I'll explain why it keeps happening later. The point here is that's the smallest change you could possibly make, right? Just changing one amino acid. And that's enough to have this drastic a change. Not only does the shape cause health problems, but also the individual hemoglobin molecules are no longer as able to carry oxygen and carbon dioxide. So even if they didn't have the misshape, they would be not doing their job nearly as well. Number 26 uses a ribbon model again to illustrate, well, to reinforce what I've already said, the importance of shape. But what this illustrates also is that there are variables in the cellular environment, the conditions the protein is in within the cell, that can affect and change the shape or conformation of a polypeptide. And I mentioned two of those, the two probably most important ones, when we were talking about acid rain. Remember that slide of the unhealthy forest? Temperature and pH are just two of several different variables, but they're two really important ones that can change the shape of proteins and therefore cause them not to work anymore. The protein is still there. It still has the same primary structure because the sequence hasn't changed, but the environmental conditions has affected the way in which it folds up into three dimensions. And if that happens, if it goes from having the correct, so to speak, folding to an incorrect one, we call it denaturation. The protein is said to be denatured. Now, if it is not quite drastic enough, any sort of denaturation is going to affect the function because it's a shape change and function is based on shape. If it's not too drastic, for instance, if the temperature's changed just a tiny amount or the pH, yes, it will affect the function of the protein, but if you restore conditions to normal temperature or normal pH, before it gets too denatured, then it might renature. If you restore the conditions, it's going to go back into the same shape for the same reason it went into that shape to begin with, because that's the way the R groups interact. But if you change the variables too much, it will be permanently denatured. And that protein, as a molecule, is now worthless in terms of function. It's not entirely worthless because it's made out of amino acids. So the cell can dismantle it and reuse those amino acids just like you could Lego blocks to build a fresh one, but that one that's been permanently denatured is no longer going to work. And that's why it's such a big deal to maintain variables within limits as part of homeostasis so that proteins can do their job. It shows you the importance of proteins in doing just about everything in the cell. 27 is kind of interesting because for some proteins to take on their shape when they're first built requires the help of still other proteins. So there are some proteins that as soon as they come off the assembly line, hooking together the sequence of amino acids, conditions will be right in the cell for them to just fold up into their proper shape without any help. Other proteins, though, do require some help. And the helpers are proteins themselves that are called chaperone proteins or chaperonins that act as little canisters, basically. The shape of the chaperone protein is such that it has a hollow interior into which the brand new unfolded protein is put. Right here, this polypeptide's brand new. It doesn't have its shape yet. And it can't attain its shape unless it gets away from everything else, basically, by putting itself into this little canister made out of a different protein. And then the conditions are just right inside there that it will fold up and it can then be exited. Correctly folded protein. So it's proteins helping other proteins take on their shape so that they can have their proper function. Now, 28 is kind of a segue slide because it serves as the final slide in the protein section of the chapter, but also the first slide in the nucleic acid section of the chapter. Nucleic acids is the only one we haven't talked about yet in this chapter, right? We've been through polysaccharides, lipids, polypeptides, and now we're going to talk about nucleic acids, which can also be called polynucleotides. More about that in a minute. But this really illustrates what I've been talking about as far as DNA's involvement of proteins is concerned. DNA is not directly involved in the production of proteins. It's indirect. What DNA directly is involved in is just the first of the two major steps involved in making a protein, which is transcription. What we call gene expression consists of two steps. To express a gene means to use it. It's, you know, genes are kind of like assembly manuals in a library. At any given moment, most of those manuals are not being used, right? They're just on the shelf. No one's reading them. No one's using them to assemble anything. So those are unexpressed genes at the moment. But when you express a gene, you're effectively taking that manual out, looking at it, following the instructions in it, in order to build a protein, usually. And that consists of two steps, transcription and translation. Transcription first. But transcription is the only part of gene expression that the gene is actually involved in, the DNA. And that involves reading the information that's in the DNA, which is itself a polymer. So it has information because a polymer has a sequence of monomers that make it up. Okay, that's the information in DNA. That's used in the process of transcription to build a different kind of nucleic acid. DNA is a nucleic acid to begin with, but transcription uses the information in DNA, one type of nucleic acid, to build a second kind of amino acid called RNA, specifically messenger RNA. And DNA is now done as far as the process is concerned. This is analogous in a library to a non-circulating book, one that you're not allowed to remove from the library, right? You have to go to the library and use it there and keep it there. So if you really need that information, you just can't remember it, what you're going to do is write it down, right? In other words, transcribe it. That's what transcribe means, rewrite. That's what transcription is. It uses the information in DNA to make a copy of that information in the form of RNA, which can then leave the library, can leave the nucleus. Right here we're looking at one that has a nucleus. Not all cells have a nucleus, but eukaryotic cells do. Okay? That's transcription. And then translation involves using the messenger RNA code to tell this brown thing out in the cytoplasm, outside the nucleus, how to actually assemble the polypeptide. In other words, which amino acid of the 20 to use in each position, and then tell it when it's done. You've now added enough. And when that happens, you have a string of beads, a polypeptide. That's the primary structure, right? That's the translation process, assembling that polypeptide. But it shows you that it goes from nucleic acid, one type of polymer, to polypeptide, another kind of polymer. Now, well, I'll talk about that in a different slide. Let's just go on to more about nucleic acids in slide 29. Nucleic acids are all polymers. Every nucleic acid is a polymer, and therefore made out of monomers. Just like the other two polymers we talked about, right? Polysaccharides are polymers made out of monomers called monosaccharides. Polypeptides are polymers made out of monomers called amino acids. Nucleic acids are polymers made out of monomers called nucleotides, which is why another name for a nucleic acid is a polynucleotide. A nucleotide itself is one monomer, but when you hook a bunch of them together, you have a polynucleotide. And so RNA and DNA are both polynucleotides. That word is actually tells you, first of all, that it's a polymer, right? Not only tells you that it's a polymer, but it tells you what the monomers are. Just like polysaccharide is made up of monomers called monosaccharides. Okay, well, I'll talk about the difference between RNA and DNA, the two categories of polynucleotides, in a minute. But let's just talk about a nucleotide in general. Here you have a polynucleotide on the left, and not a very long one, especially because when it comes to DNA, for instance, one polynucleotide, one strand of DNA, is millions of nucleotides long, not just the four that you see here. Millions for a single molecule. So they're extraordinarily long, DNA especially, extraordinarily long polymers. But they're all made out of subunits called nucleotides, and we're looking at one nucleotide in the center box. Even though a nucleotide is just one subunit, that one subunit, one nucleotide, is made up of three things. And you can see all three of them here. All right, one of those three things is a pentose sugar. What does pentose tell you? Right. The os part tells you that it's a sugar. You wouldn't even have to have the word sugar there. Pentose by itself tells you it's a sugar because of OSE. And pent means five. So it's a five-carbon sugar. But that's a category, remember, not a specific substance, right? There's multiple different pentoses, just like hexoses and the other categories. But this is a five-carbon sugar. And you can tell that just from the picture. Because remember, anything that's not labeled otherwise on a corner or a bend is a C. Well, this is an O. That's not a C. So there's one, two, three, four, and then five. That's a five-carbon sugar. That's one component of a nucleotide. You have to have a pentose sugar. And then the other two components of the same nucleotide are both hooked, but in different places, to that one pentose. One thing that's hooked to the pentose is a phosphate group. You should be familiar with those already, right? And as I said when we were talking about functional groups, this is one of the three, at least, major reasons why phosphate groups are so important to biology. You can't have any DNA or RNA without phosphates. And you also can't have any phospholipids, can't have any cells. But that's component number two, it's hooked on one side to the sugar, to the pentose, and then also hooked to the pentose, but at the other side is some sort of nitrogenous base. Nitrogenous simply mean containing nitrogen. Now I said some sort of nitrogenous base, whereas I said phosphate specifically for the other side. That's because all phosphates are the same. But the nitrogenous base you have a choice of. And as a matter of fact, the pentose, since that's a category only, you also have a choice of. So let's talk about the pentose. On the bottom right here, we see the two choices, and this is the fundamental difference between the two categories of nucleic acids, RNA and DNA. A nucleotide has either this pentose in it, which is ribose, and look at the structural formula here. You should recognize this as a sugar, by the way. It looks very similar to the ones we were hooking together to make glycosidic linkages, right? It's a sugar. This one is deoxyribose. And think about what deoxyribose means. Ribose without oxygen. Deoxyribose, right? It doesn't mean utterly without oxygen. The only difference in these two structural formulae, if you haven't spotted it already, is that this oxygen connected to carbon number 2, which is part of this OH in ribose, that's not there. In deoxyribose, it's just a hydrogen rather than a hydroxyl. So deoxyribose is named for the fact that it's just like ribose without an oxygen, deoxyribose. Well, deoxyribose is what the D of DNA stands for. DNA is deoxyribonucleic acid. In other words, a nucleic acid in which every nucleotide, however many there are that make it up, has deoxyribose as the sugar part. Okay, so it's not, you don't have a mix and match of deoxyribose and ribose within the same nucleic acid. You either have a DNA strand in which every nucleotide has deoxyribose as the sugar, or you have an RNA strand in which every nucleotide uses ribose as the nucleic acid. Okay, RNA is ribonucleic acid. So it's not really a choice, is what I'm saying. If you're making RNA, you're going to definitely have to be using ribose, and you have to use phosphate. There's only one version of phosphate, right? So these two are always the same within the same nucleic acid. They're either deoxyribose and phosphate in a DNA molecule, or they're always ribose and phosphate in a ribonucleic acid, an RNA. That means the only reason that there are different kinds of nucleotides within the same overall polymer, either DNA or RNA, is because there are choices for the third position, the nitrogenous base. And those are shown in the top. Now, there's more than 5 possible nitrogenous bases chemically, but there are 5 that are naturally used in organisms for RNA and DNA. And they're shown here, all 5 of them: cytosine, thymine, uracil, adenine, guanine. But each major type, either DNA or RNA, uses just 4 of those 5. All right? Cytosine, thymine, adenine, and guanine, these 4, are the 4 that are used in DNA molecules. So any given nucleotide in a DNA molecule is going to have phosphate connected to deoxyribose, because it's DNA, and then either cytosine, thymine, adenine, or guanine in this position. If it's RNA you're building, then every single nucleotide in it is going to have phosphate connected to ribose, which is then also connected to either thymine, uracil, adenine, or guanine. In other words,
I mean, cytosine, uracil, adenine, and guanine, sorry. In other words, RNA uses uracil instead of thymine.
Thymine is used in DNA instead of uracil. And what they share are C, A, and G. Does that all make sense? If it weren't for nitrogenous bases being different, then there wouldn't be any information in DNA. The only possible information you could have in DNA, what I'm saying is all nucleotides would be the same, right, if you didn't have different nitrogenous bases. So the only information DNA could carry would be how many nucleotides there are, right? It's a lot more information if you can have different nucleotides. And that's what DNA is. It's an information-carrying molecule. The information is these specific sequence of C's, T's, A's, and G's. That's what a gene is. And a gene really is just a subsequence. It's just part of the much longer overall DNA molecule. There are thousands of genes on just one enormously long DNA. And so the DNA has a much longer sequence. A gene is just part of that sequence, but it's enough of the sequence to tell the cell how to build a corresponding sequence in RNA, that's transcription, and then that RNA will go out of the nucleus, find a ribosome, and tell that ribosome by its sequence what the sequence of amino acids has to be to build the protein. That's translation. Now, a word that I haven't described yet here is shown, which is nucleoside. Be careful with that because it differs only in one letter compared to nucleotide. A nucleotide is all three of these parts. The pentose, the phosphate, and the nitrogenous base. If you don't have the phosphate, though, if you had just the nitrogenous base connected to the sugar, then it would be called a nucleoside. All right? Well, as we'll see later, you can connect more than one phosphate to this. But if you connect just one, as you see here, then this would be called a nucleoside monophosphate. It's just another name for a type of nucleotide. We'll look a lot more later, but we've already looked at ATP on a slide, right? Which, do you remember what that stands for? Right, adenosine triphosphate. Well, adenosine is adenine as the nitrogenous base, ribose as the sugar, so imagine those in these position, and that by itself would be called adenosine, and then three phosphates connected to it, adenosine triphosphate. So ATP is also a nucleotide, but does a totally different job compared to being part of RNA. All right? Okay, so that's what nucleoside means. And what we see on the left is that when building a polynucleotide, which is a strand of however many nucleotides, just like building a polypeptide by putting amino acids together only one way, that's also true for nucleotides. So what holds the sequence together are covalent bonds between the phosphate of one amino acid and the phosphate of one nucleotide, this is one nucleotide, and the sugar of the next nucleotide. Right? This is a phosphate on this nucleotide, this is the sugar of this nucleotide. And then the phosphate of this one is in turn going to be connected to the sugar of the next one and so on. That's the only way to assemble these end-to-end. And this is why, just like for proteins or polypeptides, nucleic acids do not branch either. It's also analogous with proteins that This is the only thing holding this strand together. The nitrogenous bases are just like the R groups of amino acids. They're just hanging off of the strand. They're not contributing to holding it together at all. And therefore, since the only two things that are involved in holding it together are the sugars and the phosphates, we call that sugar-phosphate sequence the sugar-phosphate backbone. That's all about holding it together, which is really important, because if it's not held together, then you don't have the sequence anymore, right? It's like having a bunch of little letters, typesetting letters, which is an old-fashioned example now. You drop that box of typesetting letters on the ground, you no longer have words, right? It's just a pile of individual letters. So to have the information, you have to keep those nitrogenous bases in order. You do that by holding it together with the sugar phosphate backbone. But what gives it information is the actual sequence of the nitrogenous bases that are hanging off. That's what the cell interprets as the information. All right? And that's why it's important for these sugar phosphate bonds to be strong, which they are. They're covalent bonds. If these were hydrogen bonds, the thing would easily break apart, right? You want it to be a strong strand. Okay, now let's go to 30. This specifically is DNA. And one thing you can say about DNA compared to RNA, other than the fact that they use different sugars in their nucleotides, is that DNA is typically a double-stranded nucleic acid. And it's a bit of a word game, by the way. We talk about a DNA molecule. Well, a single DNA is really two molecules, because it's two strands that are coiled up with each other in a double helical arrangement. That's why you see two ribbons here. Each ribbon corresponds to a sugar phosphate backbone of a single polynucleotide. A polynucleotide is one complete molecule, right? However many nucleotides long. Well, what we call one DNA really has two of those. And they remain separate molecules because they're not chemically bonded together. Instead, they are bonded together by hydrogen bonds, which is what these black ellipses indicate. The hydrogen bonding occurs between nitrogenous bases on opposite strands, on different polynucleotides. So this one box here shows you a single hydrogen bond between an adenine on one polynucleotide and a thymine on the other. So that's why I say it's a bit of a word game. We act like it's one molecule of DNA, but it's really technically two molecules, just like hemoglobin is technically four molecules of polypeptide. All right? But not only is this double helical in shape, it also has what is called an anti-parallel arrangement. To understand that, you have to first realize that any individual polynucleotide, which is just one ribbon, one strand, has what is called a 3' end at one end and a 5' end at the other. It's best probably to just temporarily go back to 29 to point this out. This is a strand, and it can be any length. It's still going to have at one end a so-called 3' end, because this is the third carbon in this sugar. That's why it's called the 3' end. And this one is the 5' end. That's where the phosphate is connected to the fifth carbon, which is this one hanging off of the ring. All right. So there is a polarity of sorts, not electrical polarity, but meaning a difference between the two ends. There's a 3' end and a 5' end for any single sequence of nucleotides. DNA has two nucleotides, but they're arranged head to tail or anti-parallel. So if the tip of my finger here is the 3' end of this one and the 5' end's down here, this one would be arranged with 5 prime here and 3 prime down here, head to tail, as you see in the figure here. Not only that, but there is what is called complementarity. Which means whatever the sequence is of nucleotides in one strand, which can be anything, as long as it's A's, C's, T's, and G's, it could be in any order. Whatever that sequence is, though, when you match it up with the other strand, wherever there's an A on one strand, there will be a T on the other in that same position. Wherever there is a C, there will be a G on the other. So it's a complementary arrangement. And that's truly important to how DNA works, which I'll explain next time. Or eventually in the semester. We're going to spend the second half of the term on DNA.